You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. Today we have R.A. Burrell with us. And R.A., are you on the line there?
I am. Hi, Bill.
All right. I just thought rather than me introducing you, you tell us about yourself here and what we're going to talk about is native plants. But if you could kind of give us a little background about how you got to studying and being involved with native plants, if you would.
Well, I grew up on we had a farming and ranching operation when I was a kid, and I've always had a passion for how that works and the processes involved in that. And after my first careers, I went back and got my master's in ecological restoration at Colorado State and have been pushing that passion now for several years and really enjoying it.
Well, good. Well, didn't you win an award here recently? I wanted to talk about that a little bit. I thought you won an award.
Are you referring to the Colorado Native Plant Society?
Yeah, that one. Yeah.
Yeah, I got a volunteer award from a volunteer organization that I spent a lot of time with last year for effectively showing up and devoting a lot of my time towards the native plants.
All right. Well, that's always good to get acknowledged when you help out people.
Yes.
Well, I thought it'd be good to sort of start out about the pristine myth that when the Europeans got here, everything was perfect. The wilderness was just wonderful. And we know better. We know that actually indigenous tribes used prescribed burning and did a lot of other things to actually manage the landscape. And that it wasn't pristine wilderness, that people actually lived in it. And so I guess we could jump from there into native plants and why are native plants so necessary to us at this point in our history?
Right. You bring up a good point, Bill. The challenge for many people at that time for the European culture was to actually recognize how the land was being stewarded. And it wasn't something that they recognized from their experience in Europe. So they did tend to, based on what I've read, think that no one was stewarding the land. We know that's not the case and that there were people stewarding it for thousands of years. The shame in that is that there wasn't a lot of knowledge transfer from the indigenous cultures to the European cultures. A lot of knowledge was either lost or ignored. And so there were policies applied to the land that were working with scant information. And so that has led to some of the challenges that we see now, where there was a less intensive culture of land stewardship to one today where almost all the arable land is being used for production, and even more than that because we're using irrigation.
Right.
So that has produced some of the challenges that we see today.
Well, give us a little introduction about what are native plants and why are they essential ecosystems. I almost let it slip there. I use the word ecosystem management to talk about how we think we can actually outsmart Mother Nature, but let's stick to ecosystem management.
Yeah, there's a couple terms that I think are important. One of them is native plants, and that's a plant that species has been adapted to the ecosystem, and the ecosystem cultivated its traits. So the way we see it now, the color, the height, the fruit that it bears, the disease resistance, the drought tolerance, all of those characteristics it has because the ecosystem helped it generate those over time. Cultivated species, and the fancy word is cultivar, but it sounds weird, so I don't like to use it.
Okay.
The cultivated species are the ones that, instead of the ecosystem, it's humans that have changed it to give its current traits, like its taste, its economic yield, or disease resistance. And then there's the third, which is exotics. And there's a lot of other names for those, like introduced, invasive, weed, alien, foreign, non-native, imported, et cetera. But we'll group them all into exotics. And those are either natives or cultivated that have been taken from one place and put somewhere else.
Gotcha.
And it's really the difference between the natives and the exotics that will drive a lot of this conversation, I think, today. Go ahead, Bill.
All right. Yeah, I just was saying, yeah, I got you. I see what you're talking about there. So what are the benefits of native plants, if you could go through that for us a little bit here?
Sure. And I'm a big proponent, but remember that this industry that we're referring to, the people that are fans of native plants, is, as a lot of people, that almost sound like Romans because they know all of the Latin names for every plant in an ecosystem.
Okay.
And that's not me.
Yeah,
I am more focused on the processes and mechanisms and how native plants are integrated into the ecosystem. And so, that's where it gets interesting, I think, for many of us, is that a native plant fills its unique role that nothing else can do. It's unique. If we lose that, we kind of lose it forever. It's not something we can recreate in a lab because Mother Nature's been doing it for potentially millions of years.
Right.
So the uniqueness is one of the important value points to a native plant.
So, right, that makes sense, doesn't it, really? And the difference between the native plants, too, and exotics is we have another category, I think, don't we, that invasive plants that tend to occupy where the native plants might and can possibly even outsmart them. It's not a...
Yeah, like if you imagined a tropical a palm tree and you went and put it in northern Canada, it would be exotic.
Right.
It wouldn't really survive.
Right.
Whereas when we took kudzu and we imported it into the United States in the South, it was very invasive. It took off and hasn't stopped since.
So people aren't really aware that they think some plant's pretty because it looks pretty, but it could be an invasive plant. For instance, the nettle that we have native nettle, and then there's invasive nettle.
Yeah.
So how do people, are there guides or things that people can tell the difference in? How do they know the difference in some of these invasive species that are coming in?
Well, there's a couple quick ways. The first is if the name of it, and I'm not talking about the Latin name.
Right.
I'm talking about the common name. If the common names has a geographic location that is not where you are, like Chinese tamarisk in the Colorado River Basin, that's Chinese tamarisk. It is an introduced, it's an exotic. It is not from there. Generally speaking, if it has an exotic sounding geographic location in the name, you can be fairly certain that it's not from around there.
Right. That's a good way. Yeah, that's a good way to do it, isn't it?
The second way is that there are apps on the phone that are free that can take a picture of something and generally give you some assurance of what you're looking at. And that helps you identify, because I think that's what you're getting at, is how do I identify whether or not this plant I'm looking at in my yard or my neighbor's yard is a good plant or potentially a bad plant.
Got it. Yeah, I think people are looking for that. You know, how do I know whether or not this is a native plant or not? Well,
hard at home. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
It's hard at Home Depot when you're walking through and there's a beautiful purple plant that looks so lush and is 6 feet tall in front of me, not to want to throw it in the car, take it home, and put it in the ground. But that's not a surefire way to make sure that it's not something that's exotic.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. How can people, I mean, a lot of times native plants are going to be more expensive if people are considering using them. even though their benefits are going to, you know, be biodiversity and water conservation and pollinator support, what are the cost factors in native plants and why are they more expensive?
There's a couple of factors. One of the factors is that for a farmer, the yield is low. Remember that the cultivated species, we have adapted them over maybe centuries to make them very productive. But a native plant in 1 acre will produce much, much less yield than a corn crop, and they get one scrawny plant. So it takes it much longer to grow. It takes a lot more land to produce the native plant, and so it's going to be more expensive for that farmer. Does that make sense in the from an economic standpoint?
For sure, yep.
So there's long-term benefits, but that's not often what the farmer is looking for. The farmer is looking to produce something. Another cost driver is, where does the seed come from? For a cultivated species, they are often generating seeds in a field or a greenhouse where they can quickly get a machine to capture those seeds to replant, reproduce, and generate more plants. For a native, where are they? Well, they're out in some remote area spread out over a field, and you have these sweaty poor volunteers trying to walk out and collect those seeds, and that's a much more difficult task requiring a lot more labor, and there's not a lot of economies of scale.
Right. Okay. So what there's been a demand, hasn't there, for expertise in native plant landscaping, and how's that going? What's the cost factor there? Is it's going to cost more to get native plant landscapes? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that it is, but it kind of depends on the time frame that you're looking for. Like we mentioned earlier, if you grab a plant from Home Depot that's flourished and you shove it in the ground, you have immediate satisfaction. But if the drought really kicks up next year, that plant, you know, may not survive. A native plant is used to the drought. It's handled that for thousands of millions of years. It is going to survive the drought, and it will flourish over a longer time period. So it depends on whether you're wanting a short-term gratification or a long-term gratification.
Yeah, most of us like instant gratification. That's why we go to fast food places, right?
Absolutely. And so do the pollinators and the things that eat it. So if you could imagine, you're a deer and it's a long, hard winter, and there's this recently planted big, bushy plant. They're going to go, hopefully, and eat that because it's quick gratification as opposed to the native plant that hasn't come up yet. So, again, the long-term survivability of the cultivated species is questionable. And the pollinators, if you're planting all of those cultivated species and they have a lot of flowers, then the pollinators are going to go and get that pollen as opposed to the native plants, potentially. And so you're kind of increasing a feedback loop that would take energy away from the native plants because of how the pollinators work.
Okay. You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. Today our guest is R.A. Burrell. And R.A., you know, we talked a little bit about the invasive species. They're sort of, you know, become the thing to do because, you know, they're, like we just said, they grow quick and fast, and you know, the people like them, they're colorful and all that sort of thing. But that's caused some ecological balances and loss of diversity and decline of ecosystem services. So why are native plants the solution?
Well, for me, my interest is, and you mentioned it, there's biodiversity and resilience. And those two words have been used heavily in the past couple of years. And I'm not sure if everyone knows why they're important. I mean, we say it's important, but why? There's a concept called the insurance hypothesis. Let's take the pine beetle in Colorado. Recently, the beetle has decimated the pine forest. You've seen this, right, Bill?
Right, for sure. Yep.
Okay. So right now, we have another tree that's willing to take its place, the aspen. The aspen, for many locations, is happy to jump in and take over. But let's say that we didn't have that diversity, and we only had pine trees, and the beetle came in and wiped them out. What will we do then?
You tell me.
Well, maybe a group hug.
Okay.
But or Health and Human Services. But the idea is that we need that diversity as a backup. We call it insurance, but that's what it means, is that there's some other species that can hop in and fulfill that role if things go bad.
Okay, got it.
Does that answer your question?
I think so, yeah, to some degree it does. Yeah, because if native plants are the solution, it means really kind of trying to restore some balance back into the ecosystem, because the native plants in a lot of cases have been pushed aside by exotics. So how can the public support native plants? What action steps could they take to support native plants?
They can certainly volunteer at their local organizations. There are often a lot of volunteers. There's the Colorado Native Plant Society, and other states have similar organizations where people can learn how to plant inside their own properties to encourage native plants. There are extensions at many of the state universities that will help to that extent as well. There are a lot of master gardener. If they're very serious and would like to devote the time, there are master gardener programs in almost every state in the West. I would like to circle back on that last topic.
Okay.
What was the? We only got to one of the points.
Okay.
What was the question previously?
We were talking about basically what the cost is for native plants. How come they're more expensive? Weren't we? Wasn't that what we were talking about?
Yeah, but there was a point after that. I'll come back to it
I'm trying to look at my notes here, but I don't see where it is.
Why native plants? One of the reasons is that the native plants are a primary producer in the ecosystem, and they can they control and influence everything above and below the soil. So you're not just dealing with the moths or things that fly. When you're dealing with and helping the primary producer in the ecosystem, which are almost always plants, you are helping everything in the ecosystem, because everything else relies on those primary producers, which are mostly the plants. So that's why it's an important piece in the ecosystem to focus on.
Okay, got it. I'm learning this as we go, you know.
You're doing a great job.
who's doing the work now? And you know, you were talking about supporting like the Native Plant Association, the Society, and everything. But who's helping do the work, and how can our culture support this challenge of native plants and trying to get them back to where they should be? Like volunteer organizations or what?
And it's a bad term to use, but the landscape of the people in this effort are varied. There are the large organizations like the Nature Conservancy, and then there's the individual volunteer that's just going out to help for the day on a seed collection. In between that, there's the not-profits. There are the agencies that have grants of some kind. And then there are the private contractors who are being paid to go and do whatever it needs to be for native plants, like a grower. So native seeds are collected, given to a grower. They grow them out and then take those plants and go plant them wherever they need to be planted. So it's both broad, it's small, it's private, it's volunteer. It's a lot of different cultures as well. There are a lot of indigenous knowledge that we talked about.
Right.
There's a lot of science. There's even science, as you know, behind the paywall that people don't have access to. So it's very hard to know all of it. I work with some volunteers who, between their ears, have an amazing amount of knowledge. And how we stitch that together with the other knowledge that is out there is a big challenge right now. How do we get it from the individual to become common knowledge?
So the education aspect of it is important.
Education and sharing, absolutely.
So if I wanted to get involved with, you know, a volunteer group, I've collected seeds once before. That's a lot of work. And, you know, they go to someone who is then going to grow them, and then they get sold. But how can the average person, how can they get involved, I guess, at this point is what I'm working towards, besides what you've already said? Because, you know, there's seed banks. I know you might want to talk a little bit about seed banks and how, you know, some local conservation groups and seed banks are available for people that maybe they don't know about.
Yeah, the federal government has seed banks. There's even a global seed bank in case everything comes to a crashing halt on our little planet. They are keeping seeds, a variety of seeds available to restart. But most of the effort that really does make a difference in the long run are citizens who contact any local organization like Parks, Colorado Parks and Wildlife,
okay.
or the Native Plant Societies. There are a lot of local offices for the Native Plant Society that are constantly putting on events. The extensions do a tremendous education job of educating the citizenry on native plants, so that's available as well.
And, yeah, the Garfield County has an extension service too, don't they, here in Garfield County?
Yes, I think it's in Rifle, and I met some of those people, and they are motivated, they're passionate, and they're intelligent. So I think that could be a fantastic resource.
So right quick in the time we have left here, the next 3 or 4 minutes, what are some of the barriers to native plant adoption?
Well, unfortunately, there's an appearance issue. We need to get dressed up for the ball. A lot of the native plants have weird names and they look weird. So kind of a Dr. Seuss image, and it's not what people are used to. So the native plants are often foreign to them, so they're not going to plant them, or they're not going to encourage them. Secondly, you mentioned cost. That's certainly an issue. There's also the neglect. So sometimes there's property where the exotics have come in and taken off, and the homeowner or property owner didn't know to go in and take them out. So those are barriers to keeping the native plant population robust.
Well, a lot of people, too, don't know which native plants are best for their region, too. I mean, how could they find out that information?
The extension is typically the Colorado State University Extension or another state's extension would be one of the best places to start. They have fantastic knowledge related to that. They also can help sometimes source where the seeds are because it's hard to find the right seeds to start these. They're not available at a Home Depot. It's typically a specialty type of vendor, so it's hard to find them. There's fewer of them, as you mentioned, so it's a little bit harder to get started.
Yeah, and sometimes the specialized nurseries are, you know, even carry them are going to have limited stock, and it depends on the season too, doesn't it?
It definitely does. So there's less greenhouse. A lot of times the natives don't work well in a greenhouse environment. So over winter they don't come out lush like a cultivated species might. So that might work against us as a barrier to introduction. But a lot of it is knowledge. And there are sources available online.
All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate you being with us today, R.A., and thanks again, and hope to see you soon.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
Just remember, whatever you do to Mother Nature between now and our next session, second Monday of every month, do it for land's sake.